That big fine slapped on Wells Fargo highlights the marketing pressure at the nation's big banks. Good Monday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9, and make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and the WJCT app. And just ahead, we'll take your calls on the banking scandal at Wells Fargo. Did you hear about that? Give us a call, especially if you're a customer, at 549-2937. Then later in this month's First Coast Success, Karen Bruni Mathis speaks with Daily's founder Aubrey Edge, plus Cole Pepper after another tough Jaguars loss. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, the scam that ripped off Wells Fargo customers. Earlier this month, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau slapped banking giant Wells Fargo with a $185 million fine and fired more than 5,000 employees after millions of dollars in fees were charged to Wells Fargo customers through fake accounts. Now, a study put out a few years ago by two UNF professors predicted exactly this type of problem was going to happen with the introduction of a sales culture at the major U.S. banks. It's the type of office culture that places heavy pressure on workers to drum up new customers, and it's led to a host of problems. Paul Fadil is a professor with the Coggin College of Business at UNF, and he co-authored a study looking at the yin and yang of introducing a sales culture, the amalgam banking case. Professor Fadil, good morning.
Good morning.
And here's our question to callers. How angry are you to hear that Wells Fargo ripped off millions of customers with fake bank accounts, fake credit card accounts, and more? It's led to a big scandal in the banking industry, and we want your calls at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show. Also weigh in on our Facebook page. Now, Professor Fadil, this was no surprise to you. You authored a study about predicting just this thing happening that was published a few years ago. What led you to be the on the leading edge of predicting this?
Well, first I'd like to give my co-author and actually the person who truly beat the drums on this, Dr. Bruce Furtado, credit, because he has been on this subject since about 2005. And he would be considered a little bit old school by today's methods in research, where you give out surveys. Bruce actually went out there and did some interviews. I was more of a Johnny-come-lately on this, about 2008, 2009. But we actually observed what happened with hospitals in the 80s and the 90s. And we watched as the Humanas of the world started to look more at a profit-centric point of view instead of a service point of view. They started to look at turning beds and the average amount of time patients spent in the rooms and how they could go ahead and maximize their earnings. When the banks were turned loose in the 80s, it took a little longer for them to, I don't want to use the word figure it out, but for them to decide that really they could drive their stock prices up by getting more into selling at the higher levels of interest.
And this is after banks were deregulated.
This was after the deregulation took place. And as the interest rates kind of tanked post-2007, 2008 with the crisis, what ended up happening is that the banks could not lend your money out for these high interest rates anymore. So they now had to start looking to other products. Well, these products included credit cards, equity loans, anything where the interest rates were higher. So they start introducing this type of culture, and I want to say that first of all, there is no such bank as Amalgam Bank. The names have been changed to protect the guilty. To protect the guilty, of course.
your study was published in the journal Competitiveness Review.
Correct.
Okay.
And I will tell you, it's a very famous bank, and if the name of that bank was mentioned, everybody would know exactly who it was. But I will tell you, it was not Wells Fargo. And in this,
so you're saying this is endemic in the industry?
This is across many other banks. I don't want to say they all do it, but I know that most of them go this route. And introducing this sales culture did not come easy because the people who were employed with these banks, they're more looking at service and they were employed for their service. You know, the average teller does not have a college education, so they've never been in a class of sales. For Amalgam, their sales training was a whopping 2 days. Now imagine trying to teach somebody how to sell something without coming across high-pressure sales in 2 days. And then on top of that, imagine the pressure that you're putting on them to meet certain numbers. Mm-hmm. And there is no doubt that this would have happened. And if you read the article, it was actually happening back then. So, you know, there were one particular teller commented that she opened up 9 different accounts under her mother's names. They were making fake phone calls because they were counting the amount of phone calls. So they had to meet the numbers there. And any way they could alter this thing to bring their numbers up, they were doing so. And this was back in 2009, 2010.
Yeah. And we'll go to your calls in a moment with UNF's Paul Fadil of UNF's Coggin College of Business on the Wells Fargo banking scandal. The number to join us, 549-2937. And as you wrote, your findings about this bank that we won't name, Amalgam sales did increase, but problems also surfaced. There was slower service, irritated customers. The teller referral quota was unrealistic. The sales incentive system provided little motivation. The negative tended to be stressed in sales meetings. When employees raised concerns, their managers replied with silencing behaviors. So what you're saying, it sounds like, is that the culture was such that anyone who was expressing concern about these unethical practices was going to be silenced or marginalized.
That is 100% correct. And if you listened a little bit to the congressional hearings on Wells Fargo, you will hear that they did have some employees trying to blow the whistle on this as well, and they were subsequently reprimanded or in certain cases fired. I want to add that, you know, on both sides of this, there was a failure of expectations. When you go into a bank to deposit your money, whether it's a check or cash, you expect to go through the teller line, deposit your money, and leave. You don't expect to be sold or pandered to. On the flip side, when you have a job as a teller, there are certain expectations there. Then they come in and tell you that, look, if you sell X, you'll get Y, and you know, you'll get this 50-inch plasma TV if the numbers hit a certain amount. But those numbers are so unrealistic that they never, ever hit that amount. So many of them got like a little dirt devil vacuum or something like that. And it was just a disaster. And my co-author, who I give full credit for this, because he's been doing this kind of research for years and years and years. He said that in all the years he has done field research where he has gone out and interviews, he had never, ever had interviews this negative in his entire career.
Yeah.
He's had a pretty long career.
Wow. And what was your reaction when you saw Senator Elizabeth Warren grilling Wells Fargo CEO John Stumpf last week on television in the Senate hearing about this? Stump stands to walk away with a $123.6 million in severance and stocks if he retires. That seems to only increase the anger of Americans who feel that no one is going to probably be held accountable for this.
You know, one of the statements, I love sometimes when we state the obvious, because I think that's what we need to get people fully engaged as to what's going on. One of Elizabeth Warren's statements really hit home with me. She said very accurately, if a teller opens her cash box, grabs $100, 520s, and shoves them into her pocket, she not only gets fired, she probably goes to jail for theft. And what we have here that is endemic with the system is basically what Wells Fargo has done. And here we have, you know, the CEO, CFO, and the people who set this culture up grilling these $12 an hour workers to do their bidding, firing them subsequently because they need a scapegoat. And nobody seems to be paying the price here. You know, I have there's a finance professor at Coggin, you know, Parvez Ahmed, and he said, you know, in a meeting once, he says, there's an interesting dichotomy with American versus European finance books. When you open up a finance book in the United States, it says the goal of the manager is to increase the stockholder value of that organization. And when you open up that same book in Europe, written by a European author, it says the goal of the manager is to increase stakeholder value. Stakeholders are customers as well as stockholders, as well as managers, anybody who has a stake in that organization. I think that the United States many ways would be better served looking at the stakeholder value, not just the stockholder value.
Let's go to your calls right now on the Wells Fargo banking scandal with UNF's Paul Fadil. His study, published several years ago, predicted this very event happening. 549-2937, Richard in St. Augustine. Hi, Richard. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, Richard.
Thank you for allowing me to be on your radio.
Sure.
Basically, I've had an account with Wells Fargo, the reason I'm calling, and for years now they've been attempting to have us pull a credit card to be able to use the accounts and to be able to use ATMs. And I basically kept on trying to deny, no, I don't need it, I don't use ATMs, and so on. But to give you an idea of what they did, the other day I received a Visa, which was supposedly the ATM access card to be able to do any transaction, which is how they explained it to me, within the bank without having to constantly be pulling my ID, even though I go there on an every other day basis. And that was the excuse for them to pull a Visa for us to be able to operate our bank account that they've had for years. And I come to find out when pulling for a mortgage that they have pulled my credit in order for them to pull this Visa, in order for me to supposedly be able to access my accounts without having to go through too many hassles like they claimed. And for me, I find that quite aggravating. And the fact that the consumer never has an opportunity to be represented in these class action lawsuits against these banks for doing what they wish to do. And it just seems like they're just untouchable with what they do for consumers.
Yeah. Thanks, Richard. And I think a lot of people probably share Richard's point of view, even if they aren't customers or haven't had his bad experience.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I noted also in those congressional hearings was just Elizabeth Warren's frustration with the system. You know, you could hear her grilling and you could see her make these points. But in the end, she was just shaking her head. She was like, well, nothing is going to happen, but something should happen.
In fact, she was instrumental in setting up the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which helped bring this all to light.
Exactly.
But as we're seeing, it has limited teeth in terms of accountability.
Exactly. And with Richard, I want to also share, I'm going to keep this person's name and relation to me secret, but I would say a personal friend went into Wells Fargo to open and move a safety deposit box. And I happened to be with that personal friend. They kept us in there for about an hour and 15 minutes. And all this woman wanted to do was move her safety deposit box from South Florida to Jacksonville, where she had just moved. Well, about a week later, she was mailed a credit card by Wells Fargo with a $17,000 limit. She did not authorize the credit card. I was there. I witnessed it personally. She did not tell them that she wanted a credit card. They pulled her credit without any authorization whatsoever. And I was just flabbergasted that this could actually happen. She has since canceled this thing, and she doesn't believe in credit cards. But it just goes to show how brazen this has become. And I really think this is the tip of the iceberg.
Mike in Riverside. Hi, Mike. Good morning.
Hi. Hi, Melissa. How are you?
All right, thanks.
Good. I actually worked in the retail bank, Wachovia, which was subsequently purchased by Wells Fargo during the mortgage boom, and I was terminated in 2007 for my objections to the particular risky mortgage product that they wanted us to push, particularly negative amortization loans. We would have daily, I experienced the sales pressure. We had daily calls we had to weigh in on, and It was highly competitive between offices. But when I sent out an email to the Northeast Florida sales force, it wasn't within 2 hours before my boss and her boss were in my office telling me that they no longer needed my services, which I, in the end, I felt somewhat vindicated by seeing what happened to Wachovia. But in the end, but I saw the duties from the what you would consider a branch manager, someone who could help with daily operations, greet you at the door, became more of like a salesperson. And it was disheartening, and I saw a lot of shift go from real financially good products, financially sound products, to fee-based products to push everything. Now that they can't, they don't, or they're unwilling to lend the money, they saw an opportunity in fees. And I see that as going across the board as a problem with the banking industry in this country. And finally, I'll end with this. I felt really let down by President Obama by going soft on these banks. When I voted for him, I thought my vote was going to be a vote against big banks and really address this problem. And he really disappointed me that in that arena.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks for sharing all that. What about the last part of his comment? Because after the crash, after Dodd-Frank, all the hue and cry about reforming the system, and here we are.
Yeah, anybody who thinks for one moment that 180 million is nothing more, I mean, is anything more than a drop in the bucket for these big banks, you're very naive. And if you think this is going to deter or this is going to, you know, kind of push back on other banks that are basically having these practices, it's just not going to happen. Both my co-author and I, we believe that, honestly, this is the beginning. This is the tip of the iceberg. And unless these penalties become stiffer, you are going to see this again and again. And we are pushing right back to where we were in 2007, 2008 with these risky products. And they've got to figure out that, you know, again, it's a failure of expectations. It's preying on a customer who basically just wants a place to put their money. And they think that if they wave the candy in front of the three-year-old, eventually that three-year-old is going to grab at the candy. And when people are in trouble and people have hard times, they will. But the riskiness of these products, we need to be careful or else we're hitting possibly another bubble here.
549-2937 to weigh in on the Wells Fargo banking scandal. John is in downtown Jacksonville. Hi, John. Thanks for holding. Good morning.
Well, good morning, Melissa, and thank you for taking my call. I am a current Wells Fargo customer, and your guest alluded to the words shareholder, stockholder, and I want to throw in taxpayer. Right now, you know, tomorrow, and for all your listeners, you know, this city is in the process of picking out an inspector general. And I wonder how your guest and his associate have looked at the inspector general role and how procurement with government contracts has been handled. And there is a piece of legislation, a resolution that's being introduced by Councilman Cressenbeny tomorrow that would move the Yates Building, which would be the location for the inspector general.
Now you're getting way off topic, John. Way off topic. Thank you, John. Let's go to Dean on the south side. Go ahead, Dean.
Hey, first of all, Professor Bedeau, great to hear you. It'd be awesome if you guys had him back. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you. I
went to UNF, had you there. Anyways, I wanted to bring up one thing. First thing, I was a Wells Fargo, or I still am a Wells Fargo customer, and they definitely open up all types of accounts and cards. You know, you'll say no to something when they pander to you in the branch, and then you'll go home, and a week later, you'll get a letter saying that they either accepted you or rejected you for whatever you said no for. And, you know, so that's a common experience between other people who have Wells Fargo. And then second, the other caller brought up a stakeholder versus a stockholder question in what you referenced to. And I actually work as a compliance person in the arm of a European bank here locally. And they do have the stakeholder model, you know, when we look at our mission statement and stuff like that. But when you look at how even that bank and other European banks have been involved in still, you know, scandals even reaching the top like IBOR and LIBOR, do you have any commentary on that, just to further explain the stakeholder and stockholder model, anything like that?
Thanks, Gene.
Well, first of all, it's always good to hear from a former student. Small world. You know, I guess my thought here is that any model that considers the totality of the organization instead of just the shareholder wealth, to me, is a more accurate depiction of the success of the organization or the failure of the organization. And I might tell you, I have bank accounts at Wells Fargo as well. So all these people calling in and saying, I'm a Wells Fargo customer, you're talking to one. And
has this ever happened to you?
No, it hasn't happened to me. But like I said, I was right there with that personal friend and actually observed it with my own two eyes. And, you know, when I see what's going on, some people would say that Wells Fargo is a tremendous success. Their stock price has gone through the roof. They've been a very sound investment for people on the Dow. And they would actually comment on the fact that this is the way businesses are supposed to be run. I have a feeling, though, that seeing what we're seeing now, most people would say differently, but again, with this minor slap on the wrist on the $180 million, and now they're not, you know, even supposed to admit any guilt, even though obviously through the hearings, you know, the CEO was obviously admitting that the buck stops here. At the end of the day, unless something is pushed forth here, this is the beginning. This is not the end unless
what we type enact of regulation do you think should be enacted then?
Oh my God, you're beyond my scope here, but I do believe that there needs to be stiffer penalties.
What would be an appropriate penalty?
Financially, I would say this needs to be in the $1 billion range. And I would like to see people, even if it's for a short term, I would like to see people serve time in prison.
Yeah.
There needs to be penalties here.
Ben is on the south side. Hi, Ben. Good morning.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to weigh in on two quick things. I've got an MBA from a pretty small business school in the Midwest. And I do want to point out, I graduated in 2010 from there, and we were the idea of stakeholder value was pounded into us from beginning to end. It was not stockholder value; it was stakeholder value, and that always included, you know, your customers, your business associates, your clients, and also, you know, things like the environment as well. So, you know, your Ivy League business will definitely go on the stockholder value. They're more, you know, we call them corp type MBAs. Those guys are definitely, you know, having some issues there, but not all MBAs are created equal. The other thing I wanted to point out is I think under Sarbanes-Oxley and Dodd-Frank, you know, there should be some criminal avenues of attack here. You know, those say that, you know, upper level managers should be able to be held criminally liable for the actions of their underlings if they're signing off on them. So I don't understand why that's not being pushed as much right now.
Let's explain why. Thanks for the call, Ben.
Well, let me go back to the stakeholder versus stockholder. I do want to say the stakeholder view is a much more long-term view. Increasing the share price as much as possible is a very short-term view. So I think any solid business looking to be around for the long haul will go for the stakeholder value. As far as a criminal, you know, again, if Dodd-Frank and these laws did have the teeth, I think we would have seen them already. And again,
and we saw the fight over Dodd-Frank. That
right.
was a very difficult process
to even enact. So when you look at it, you know, yes, you know, Wells Fargo, let the public shaming begin. Wells Fargo had their moment, you know, to be shamed in front of the entire country. But at the end of the day, I have a feeling that if there were criminal charges that were going to be brought, they would have probably been brought already. So this is a great test case because, again, from what I am seeing, I think Wells Fargo is just one of many that are at least one of two that are, you know, enacting in these practices.
It's a fascinating study published by Professor Paul Fadil with Coggin College of Business at UNF. He co-authored it with Bruce Fortato several years ago, talking about the dangers of sales culture in banking. In the wake of the Wells Fargo scandal, it was certainly ahead of its time. Thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure. I hope to be back soon. Thank you.
And much more still ahead later. Culpepper on Gus Bradley's precarious position as the Jaguars lose at home. But up next, First Coast Success profiles Daly's CEO, Aubrey Edge. Back in a moment.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
The Flagler College Forum on Government and Public Policy begins with Stan Kohlender, Federal Budget Consultant, September 27th, 7 p.m. inside the Lewis Auditorium. More information at flagler.edu/events.
From the Panhandle to the Peninsula, the Sunshine State's politics are as hot as the weather. Trump versus Clinton, the race for the U.S. Senate, new political boundaries and familiar issues. Join 89.9 every Friday at 1 p.m. for Decision Florida. Let your voice be heard.
In 1933, Alan Hovhaness was a young composer fascinated by astronomy. While reading Dante's Divine Comedy, he stumbled across the line, "O human race born to fly upward." That line sparked 50 years of musical ideas inspired by the idea of space travel. Listen for Star Dawn by Hovhaness on the next performance today from APM.
Weeknights at 7 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, First Coast Energy opened its very first Daly's store in 2004 with the hopes of changing the way consumers looked at gas station convenience store combos. Daly's offers premium coffee, high-end wine and champagne, milkshakes, healthy snacks, all under the slogan, "It's nicer here." Well, nicer seems to be working. CEO Aubrey Edge explains why to Karen Bruni Mathis of the Daily Record in today's First Coast Success.
You see them all over town, and soon you will see the name on the new amphitheater at Everbank Field. The name is Daly's, which is a brand of Jacksonville-based First Coast Energy, and it's more than 200 Shell stations in Florida and North Carolina. First Coast Energy will sponsor the amphitheater as Daly's Place. Aubrey Edge is president of First Coast Energy and its predecessor, Petro Distributing Incorporated, which was created in 1994. Revenue now tops $1 billion, and its workforce tops 1,000 employees. In 2004, Edge and his partners branded the Daly's concept, whose motto is, "It's nicer here." Aubrey Edge, welcome to First Coast Success.
Thank you, Karen.
Sponsoring the amphitheater will put the Daly's name front and center in the city's entertainment and sports industry. How did you and your partners decide to do this?
Well, it's a great fit for us. We really couldn't be more excited about this partnership with the Jaguars. We think Daly's Place is going to be one of the best things to happen to downtown Jacksonville in a long time, and we're very proud to be a part of it. And, you know, it's very innovative. It's going to be one of a kind. It's going to be a high-quality product, and we think those are things that are all synonymous with Daly's, so we think it's a great fit.
And what sparked that partnership? How did it come about?
That's a great story, actually. We've had a good relationship with the Jaguars for quite some time. And when Shad Khan came in, he brought a new team with Mark Lamping and Scott Massey and many others over there. And they did a lot of market research and trying to determine who gives great customer service in Jacksonville. And the company they kept hearing about was Daly's. So they called me up and talked to us, and one thing leads to another, and we became a sponsor of theirs, number one. But more importantly, we put in the first convenience store inside an NFL stadium that's ever existed, and we're very proud of that. Particularly as a football fan, I'm extremely kind of happy about that one. That's pretty cool.
Well, now Daly's is well known. It will be even better known locally with that. And that shines the spotlight on you, too. What brought you to Jacksonville?
Well, I'm not sure that it really should shine a spotlight on me. You know, our employees are really, really pretty special. And I know everybody probably says that. But we have, I think, the best employees in the industry. We really do. And our store managers and everyone in our management team, they really embrace what Daly's is all about and trying to make a customer experience that's exceptional and living up to our tagline of it's nicer here. And they're really the ones who deserve all the credit.
And that does go back to you forming the company, though. What brought you to Jacksonville? How did you get involved in starting this?
Well, we had an opportunity to buy a number of BP stations back in late 1993, and I came in as part of that. And we have a couple of partners who were putting that deal together. I came in to run it. It was a lot of work to get a company off the ground from scratch. No operating procedures, no accounting procedure, but you had operating assets. So we had an exciting time, to say the least, getting that up and going. And it's been nothing but exciting all the way in seeing us grow from that beginning to where we are today.
How did the Daly's and Daly's Dish and motto come about? Because that grew out of all of the processes and procedures and all of the research and customer service experience. How did that evolve?
Right. So Daly's, we wanted to do something special in the convenience store industry. And so we wanted to develop our own prototype for a convenience store. So in 2004, we introduced Daly's. And part of what we had as our underlying premise was to always default to what the customer wants and to have an abiding commitment to quality. And so we started doing things that were a little different, a little special from what other people were doing at the time. We introduced high-end wines before some others were doing in the marketplace. We did things like a gluten-free section before it became very popular to do that. We've always tried to look and see what would appeal to our customers and try to introduce those products before they ask for them.
You've been expanding Daly's, and a lot of competitors are in the market as well, and they are expanding. You know, Jacksonville-based Gate Petroleum, Atlanta-based Racetrack. You have Wawa coming into town, which we hear a lot about. How competitive is this industry?
Our industry is very competitive. That could be an understatement, actually. But I think, for us at least, the key is to just remain focused on what the customer wants and what the customer is telling us that they want. And a great example of that is with our Dash concept that we introduced in 2013. We started sourcing products with Dash, and the commitment to quality was our priority. And things that the customer will never see what went into the development of Dash. For example, we get our baguettes from Tribeca Bakery out of Chicago. We get our ciabatta bread dough from the La Brea Bakery out of California. We source other breads locally. Our deli meats, we source directly at a very high quality. We think it's going to be competitive or better than anything you'll find even in a grocery store. It's that commitment to quality and all of the time and attention went to develop those products before we let anyone even try a sandwich, because all we want the customer to know is to try one of our sandwiches, and when they say, wow, that really is good, then we've been successful.
Well, Aubrey Edge, president of First Coast Energy, thank you for joining First Coast Success.
Thank you, Karen.
And you can read a complete transcript of Karen's talk, or a partial transcript, rather, of Karen's talk with Aubrey Edge in today's Daily Record. We'll be right back.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Yahoo says information from 500 million users was stolen by hackers. This comes amid growing concern over intrusions into U.S. election systems. In an era of increasing state-sponsored cyber threats, protecting our personal data and the integrity of U.S. voting.
Weekdays at 10, right after First Coast Connect on 89.9 FM WJCT.
WJCT is a community-supported station, and your contribution helps programs like our radio reading service for those who are visually impaired or have difficulty handling printed materials. If you'd like to specifically help radio reading, denote that on your check and send it to us at WJCT 100 Festival Park Avenue, Jacksonville, Florida, 32202. And thanks for helping us give voice to the printed word.
If you're looking for the best blues show, look to the Blues Horizon. Each week, join me for the best blues, both classic and contemporary. Blues Horizon, every Monday night at 11 p.m. on WJCT 89.9 FM radio. Take a ride with us to some unknown places of musical light and shade. Blues Horizon, every Monday night at 11 on 89.9 FM. So many roads.
Welcome back. It's a unique program offering help to sufferers of Parkinson's disease, all through the sport of boxing. Yeah, boxing. With 85, now 86 affiliates in the U.S. and abroad, Rock Steady Boxing is taking off. And there's even a chapter on Amelia Island. Marianne Scherer and Guy Petty are co-founders of Rock Steady Boxing Amelia, and join us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Thanks for being with us. So this first sort of came to national attention with a piece that Leslie Stahl did on 60 Minutes. Is that what inspired you to create a chapter on Amelia Island for Rock Steady Boxing?
Actually, I believe it was on the CBS Morning Show.
CBS Morning Show, sorry. Yes. Okay.
And Guy was diagnosed with Parkinson's about a year and a half ago, and a few months later received an article in the mail from his brother in Pittsburgh, and he'd read an article about a program that started in Indianapolis in 2006 aimed at stopping the progression of Parkinson's disease. So, of course, we dived in to see what we could discover, and both of us thought this is something we really have to do, not only for Guy, but for other people in the area who have Parkinson's.
Guy, how has this helped you and other patients?
Well, for all of us, we're seeing that there, even in our local one, and in less time than a year, we're seeing people who are arriving in a walker and leaving a year later without the walker anymore. And
get out. That's great.
Yeah, people's tremors who, you know, well, and one of the easiest ways to spot a Parkinson person is a tremor usually.
Sure.
And we all know somebody who has Parkinson's.
Yeah.
And there are probably a million in the United States, with 60,000 coming on each year. So it's a growing disease, but the interesting part is it can be reversed.
How does this program work to do that, Marianne?
Well, yeah.
It's interesting. They have shown that all the things that go into training for boxing, such as skipping rope and stepping over things for balance, and even incorporated in this program has been shouting and yelling, because people who have Parkinson's tend to lose their voice mm-hmm. control, mm-hmm. Really hits right at the symptoms and the effects of Parkinson's.
There's something about the act of boxing mm-hmm. that counteracts what's going on in the brain of a Parkinson's patient?
What's typically happening is people who have the Parkinson's typical problems will often not be able to move, not be able to execute in areas that are three-dimensional. So the minute your hands are in front of your face and you're having to respond to someone else who's throwing punches at you, it's a non-contact sport, so we don't really ever hit at each other. So it's not the Muhammad Ali kind of story.
Yeah,
it's fending.
It's fending, but it's just that by doing the different motions, it turns out that they mirror so well what boxers have always been doing. If you take out the striking and hitting part, you've got an exercise regime that's very rigorous. And it turns out there are really three things. We've had a breakthrough in medicines. Dopamines are now there, and that helps the system. Exercise is a big piece. And drinking water.
All those things cures. Work together. So how are you enjoying life after doing rock steady boxing for a while?
Well, I'm in my first year, but I've seen a reduction in the tremors that I had. My balance issues are going away. My voice is my remaining one, and that's just doing some shouting. So I sing in the car and do other things,
great.
And that's all making me healthier and better, and I can see a change.
That is so exciting. And as I said, Marianne, you and Guy are the founders of the 86th local chapter of Rock Steady Boxing on Amelia Island. Training sessions meet several days a week.
Mm-hmm. Monday, Wednesday, Thursday at 2 o'clock, and we're going to be meeting with people who are in the program to see if there are better times for them, especially people who want to come from Jacksonville, because we had a lot of phone calls from Jacksonville, including from the Mayo Clinic, who were very pleased to hear that we were doing this.
Uh-huh.
And I believe there is one coming to Jacksonville, probably in March or April.
All right. But in the meantime, you need to get in touch with Guy and Marianne on Amelia Island. It's the local chapter of Rock Steady Boxing, helping patients with Parkinson's disease. Look for them on Facebook or give you a call at 310-6678. Best ways to contact you, correct?
Actually, it's at Advanced Muscle Therapy, and I have a phone number for them, too.
Okay.
Which is 904-491-4980. You get evaluated and then join the class.
What a great program.
It's a great fight metaphor.
It sure is. And I'm so pleased to share it with everyone. Again, it's Rock Steady Boxing on Amelia Island. If you have a loved one or you yourself are dealing with Parkinson's, you need to get in touch. Guy Petty, Marianne Scherer, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Culpepper's up in a moment.
On the next Fresh Air, Mark Wahlberg stars in the new disaster thriller Deepwater Horizon, about the last hours on the oil rig that sank after explosions and fire causing the BP oil spill. We'll speak with director Peter Berg about making the film. Berg also directed Friday Night Lights. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Unlock your newest member benefit. Over 1,000 episodes of your favorite PBS shows. American Masters. Antiques Roadshow. Nova. masterpiece. Watch the best of PBS anytime, anywhere. Become a member, sign in, and start streaming today.
WJCT.org/passport.
Classical music is available 22 hours a day on WJCT 89.9 FM HD2. Find out how you can listen to classical music by calling 358-6390. Enjoy classical music day or night on 89.9 HD2.
Well, finally, this hour, a heartbreaking loss for the Jaguars once again. How much longer does Coach Gus Bradley have?
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Cole Pepper is the answer to that, and some more sports news and notes this Monday. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. If I had the actual answer, that would be something, but I think I can give you a pretty good guess as to what we're looking at here in terms of the impact of the game. Uh-huh. Yesterday, we can get into some of the details of why it happened. Bad quarterback play, untimely penalties, the inability to make plays in crunch time, and they wind up losing 19-17 to the Baltimore Ravens. Mm. Ravens people, by the way, were asking afterwards, how do we win this one? So the Ravens now 3-0, the Jaguars 0-3, and we knew that this first four-game stretch of the season was going to be a defining stretch of the season for the Jaguars and probably for Gus Bradley, who, as we talked about last year, was, you know, the hot seat was building. Well, now it is absolutely scorching. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that the move is going to be made this week, but I think you could potentially see a change if there was another bad performance in the game in London on Sunday against the Indianapolis Colts. So think about the stretch of quarterbacks. The Jaguars have had to play three-time MVP Aaron Rodgers. They've had to play probable future Hall of Famer Phillip Rivers, Super Bowl-winning quarterback Joe Flacco, and then Andrew Luck next week. It's a tough gauntlet, but they've not performed, and that's just the bottom line with it. So would Shad Khan make a move in midseason, especially this early in the season? He's been very, very, very patient with Gus Bradley to this point, but I think the writing now is just about on the wall.
And so as they head off to London, how are you liking that next matchup?
Well, you know, the Colts have not exactly been world beaters. They're 1-2 this year. The Jaguars do have experience going over to London, and last year they won in London, mm-hmm. so they've learned how to handle that and treat that as a business trip. So there's a chance they could go, and it would not be a huge upset for the Jaguars to win that game. The question is, coming back with a bye week to follow, really is the optimum time to make a move if you're going to, because they have an assistant coach named Doug Marrone, who once was the head coach of the Buffalo Bills on staff. They could promote him to that position. He could be the interim head coach for the rest of the year as they try to figure out what's to come. You wouldn't have to make major changes, mm-hmm. but there just comes a point. I mean, Gus Bradley is now 12-39 in his career as the head coach of the Jaguars, and very few coaches in NFL history have been given this kind of a rope to turn things around.
And when you look at college coaches, do they have even less of a rope?
Well, sometimes
like
it depends
miles,
on where you are.
For
yeah,
example.
And the Les Miles example, of course, last year he was basically fired, and then there was a 180 done, and they got a little bit of support from some boosters, and they stuck it out because they haven't started off well. He was let go. There is, when you talk about the NFL and you talk about major college football, when you have major donors, a lot of money, a lot of interest in the SEC or the Big Ten and some of the bigger schools and other conferences, there is such pressure to perform that it's not unusual at all. Now, if you compare the kind of tenure that Les Miles has had at LSU with, say, some professional soccer coaches in England, those guys get turned over several times. Shad Khan's team, Fulham, has gone through four different managers since he's owned it. So It's not as if it's the least secure position, but when you're paying a guy that kind of money and you have that much riding on it, whether you're talking about college or pro football, lack of production just isn't going to fly.
Yeah. Okay. Well, as we watch for the fate of Bradley, let's talk college football. And the Armada suffered a heartbreaker of their own over the weekend.
It was a rough weekend if you were a local fan for most of the teams. Jaguars, of course, the loss. Florida blew a 21-3 lead at Tennessee, wound up losing for the first time in 12 years to the Vols. Florida State had a win against South Florida, but wasn't particularly impressive. And Georgia got blown out by Ole Miss. So rough weekend for college, most football fans in the area. The Armada up 1-0 in stoppage time, and a controversial, to say the least, penalty was called. And Ryo Oklahoma City able to convert and earn a 1-1 draw. After the game, Armada owner Mark Frisch and others tweeting less than pleasant thoughts about the about the call. And I've gone back and looked at it. I was calling the game on TV.
Yeah.
I just don't see how the call could have been made. It was, and it cost the Armada a couple of points.
Kind of a sad weekend all around, because we also want to make note of two star athletes who passed away over the weekend, Jose Fernandez and Arnold Palmer.
Yeah, you talk about guys at both ends of their careers, and I think when you talk about Jose Fernandez, young Cuban pitcher who defected to the United States, tried three times to come to the United States, had been arrested, and finally made it here and was pitching for the Marlins, came up as a 20-year-old, and at just 24 years of age, he was out in a boat with two friends, and early Sunday morning, overnight Saturday, early Sunday morning, the boat hit some rocks, and he was killed at the age of just 24.
So tragic.
It really is, and some of the stories about how he was able to bring, with the Marlins franchise, bring his grandmother to the United States, just heartwarming stories, and just a tragic loss of a great young pitcher in Jose Fernandez. On the other end, Arnold Palmer at the age of 87, you can hardly call it a tragedy, but what a loss for the golf community.
Yeah.
Nobody did more to bring golf into the mainstream than Arnold Palmer, and I think a lot of folks will be mixing a little iced tea and lemonade,
today. Yep. Exactly right. I was just going to say that. You read my mind. And follow Cole on Twitter at Cole Pepper for all your sports news and notes, and check out the Sam and Cole podcast while you're at it. That's our show today. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. Diane Rehm is up next. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow with reaction to tonight's big presidential debate between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. That's tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.